And this is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Autism is often described as a disorder of social interaction, where those with the condition seem wired differently than most. Autistic children may have a hard time with language. They may be sensitive to bright lights and loud sounds, focus obsessively on one activity or one object, and don't relate to others in the usual way. Autism cases are up 300% just over the past decade. And in her series, Challenges of Autism This Week, NHPR correspondent Cheryl Rich-Kern examined how this dramatic rise is being felt across New Hampshire. The impact is huge. Families with autistic kids struggle to understand their children's condition and to pay for treatment. Public school systems work to integrate autistic students into the classroom, but often lack resources to do so. Health providers are examining what the best practices are for helping these children, but therapies are expensive and often not covered by insurance. And meanwhile, everyone is wondering what's causing these autism numbers to grow. Today, a week-long series on autism ends here on The Exchange, looking at what we've learned from Cheryl Rich-Kern's series and where the state goes from here. And let's get you into our conversation. Are you a parent, a teacher, or health provider who has personal experience with autism? Are you autistic yourself? How do you see the state handling the growing numbers of those with this condition? What personal challenges have you had with autism? Give us a call, The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. We have three guests with us by phone. It's Kirsten Murphy. She's director of the New Hampshire Council on Autism Spectrum Disorders. And Kirsten, good to have you. Welcome back to The Exchange.
Thanks very much. Nice to be here.
Also with us, Ellen Cavanaugh, nurse practitioner at the Department of Child Development at Dartmouth Hitchcock in Lebanon. And Ellen, welcome. Nice to see you.
Thank you for inviting me.
Also with us, Cheryl Rich-Kern, NHPR reporter, who, as I just mentioned, put together a week-long series, which concludes today, called Challenges of Autism. And Cheryl, thanks a lot for being here and for putting this whole thing together.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, and Cheryl, what's the big takeaway, do you think, from this series that you did this week?
Well, I knew the incidence of autism was higher than it had been, but I actually had no idea how prevalent it was and how many families are dealing with this and what the impact it's having on them economically and on their stress levels and their family dynamics, because it doesn't just affect the child, it's the parents, it's the siblings, the extended family. It's also having a huge impact on schools, and schools are handling it differently than I had seen in the past. Educators are trying to include more kids with autism in the general education classroom, include them for longer periods of the day. And in talking with families of older children, by that I mean children who are maybe like 18, I found that kids really can get better. So that was good to hear. I mean, there was one family I talked to with an 18 or 19-year-old young man who was going to college and finishing high school at the same time. And when he was younger, his diagnosis was rather bleak. The doctors had said he may not speak. He may never be potty trained. And he was, obviously. I was talking with him, and he had gotten early intervention. So that was good to see. Another eye-opener for me was that there are a lot of fundraising efforts around autism. There are groups like Reverse Autism Now, Let's Stamp Autism Out of the Picture. But I was hearing from people that were saying, hey, autism it's not a disease. And by the way, I'm autistic, and if you could hear the music in my head, you wouldn't want to change a thing. And that was a little bit new to me, this movement that was saying, we need greater awareness of autism, not necessarily to stamp it out, but to let others accept us for who we were. So those are some of the things I came across as I was doing my reporting.
Real interesting. And we'll dive into all of those, especially that aspect that you said at the end, Cheryl, where, you know, some older people, young adults with autism said, no, I really wouldn't take a pill and change this if I had the opportunity. So I'm different. It's difficult, but it has some benefits too. Kirsten Murphy, I'd love your perspective. I know that you were part of the series that Cheryl did this week on autism. What do you think everybody learned from this?
Kudos to Cheryl Rich-Kern, because she really touched on many of the really key issues in the community that cares about autism. For me, the big picture was the continued need to develop the state's human services infrastructure, if you will, to provide the kinds of services that young children need, the supports that young adults are going to need to be successful in the workplace. Unfortunately, that's going to take some money, and that's not anything anybody likes to ask for currently in the state budget. But we need to continue to improve services so that we have those wonderful examples of kids who are doing so well after intensive treatment, which has been my experience as a parent of a boy with autism.
Right, Kirsten, just remind us of your personal experience with this condition.
Well, my son is 16 now, and I was told when he was 9 that he really would need to go to an institutional setting, that he could not be educated. And I disagreed. I said, I can't kiss him goodnight if you do that. So he stayed, and we worked much more intensively. We got a great program for him, and he is now a junior at Hanover High School. He just got his first varsity letter in cross country, and he's making honor roll.
Wow.
And he's going to be going to college.
Wow. Well, that's quite the story, just like you said, Cheryl. Sometimes, often these things can work out positively. I'd like to get you into this too, Ellen Cavanaugh. Again, you're at Dartmouth Hitchcock in Lebanon. The big picture, when we look at autism, what are some of the big impacts that these rising numbers are having on the Granite State?
Well, first of all, we don't know why the numbers are rising. It's probably because more children are being identified early, and that's good because early intervention, especially before the age of kindergarten, puts these children in a much better place for having their developmental milestones achieved in regular order. As we identify more children, we're putting them into the educational system. We're educating parents. We're educating the public. We're educating teachers about what to look for. And because it's a spectrum disorder, we have some children with very mild symptoms and some with more severe. And the more severe children are easier to identify. It's the milder ones. And even the mild children are affected. And one of the things that's been brought up is the day-to-day family struggle, because the family is the primary social network for the children. Their development is disordered in that they're missing a piece of the social interaction. So that's the part that parents struggle with day-to-day. And every day I have parents, every day in my practice there's two or three autistic children sitting at home because they can't be educated. And it's not because they don't have a good educational program in place or an invested family. It's because they mismatch on a day-to-day basis.
What do you mean by that, Ellen, mismatch?
They have, if the program gets disrupted, for example, I have one child, well, I have two sitting at home right now with their parents, might be listening. The school system can't educate them, one because of disruptive behavior, another because he's just a little bit rigid, and he's gotten ostracized. And so the school systems have both said, we can't take him in because they're too aggressive. And so the child sits at home, and the reason they're aggressive, or one is aggressive and one is rigid, is because the system changed unpredictably for the families. It was a good system. They had good programs. They had excellent IEPs. In one situation, the paraeducator changed.
IEP is individualized
educational
plan.
It's
right.
Their educational prescription and treatment plan. But if it changes, if something changes in that program, this really disturbs the children.
Well, and change is difficult for all kids, but probably especially for children with autism.
It's absolutely.
Let me give out the phone number and invite our listeners to join us. And then I have one more question for you, Ellen. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, we're wrapping up a series by NHPR correspondent Cheryl Rich-Kern. It's called Challenges of Autism. In it, Cheryl has looked at why this diagnosis is up 300% over the last decade and the wide-ranging impact on families, schools, communities, health providers. Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. If you are someone with firsthand experience with autism, let us know about the personal challenges that you have faced. And overall, how well do you think the state is doing in terms of dealing with these rising autism numbers? 1-800-892-6477 is our number here in the Exchange, or email exchange at nhpr.org. And Ellen, just one more medical question for you. I think the big surprise for those of us who aren't involved in this day by day is that 300% number, a 300% increase over the past decade. You said that some of that may be because we're just more aware, we're diagnosing more. Is that all there is, or is there something else?
That is probably the reason, is we're better at diagnosing. We've expanded the definition. We're better at picking up traits that could be on the spectrum. And we're better at prescribing treatments for those students. So that's probably the reason that it's increasing. And it's increasing across the country.
And there's a genetic component, too, right?
There's some genetic component there. Definitely there's a contribution genetically. What that means exactly in the treatment is unknown at this point because there's so many genes that are involved. But there is some genetic component. And some families have more than one child with on the spectrum.
Kristen, what's been your experience in terms of the research, the questioning, the wondering why these numbers are going up so much? I'm sure you've looked at this.
Well, there are many smart scientists working on this that are probably in a better position to comment. But clearly there is a change in the way that we're identifying people. I meet adults in the developmental services system today who were thought to have an intellectual disability when they were children. That was just the going assumption for them. And when I meet them today, I realize that they have what we would now call autism, but did not call autism then. And sadly, they were did not receive the kind of education that they could have had, in part because of a misunderstanding of what their capacity would have been and still is. So there's clearly some of that. And as for the question of genetics versus environmental triggers, there's still a lot of unanswered questions.
Okay, and coming up, we will talk with a young adult who has autism, founder of the Autism Self-Advocacy Network, and we'll start taking your calls, too. So stay with us.
Good morning, it's 919. Support for NHPR comes from your members. And support also comes to us from Granite State Credit Union, celebrating 65 years of full financial service to New Hampshire residents and businesses, federally insured by NCUA, online at gscu.org. From Antioch University, New England and Keene, offering master's programs in counseling and dance movement therapy, information at antiochne.edu. More on the challenges of autism on The Exchange on NHPR at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. It's the Friday News Roundup. New Hampshire weather for today, sunny with high temperatures, lower 50s, northern parts of the state, upper 50s in the south. A mostly clear night tonight, lows upper 20s north, lower 30s in the south. Tomorrow, sunshine, highs mid-40s north, around 60 in the south. And Sunday, partly to mostly sunny, high temperatures, mid-40s north country, lower 50s in the south. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're wrapping up a series by NHPR correspondent Cheryl Rich Kern. It's called Challenges of Autism. We're taking your calls at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We go now to someone who was included in Cheryl's series, Ari Ne'eman, founder of the Autism Self-Advocacy Network and a member of the National Council on Disability. And Ari, really nice to have you. Thanks for your time.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to join you.
Well, tell us your story, if you could, Ari, how and when you were diagnosed with autism or Asperger's, which is a high-functioning form of autism. Tell us about that, Ari.
Well, I was diagnosed at age 12, the diagnosis of Asperger's had only recently been recognized in the country at the time. And, there was a recognition that I was running into a number of challenges in terms of the social environment at the school I attended, and the Asperger's diagnosis made sense in terms of explaining that. And I do want to mention one thing very quickly. I think many folks on the spectrum have a problem with the language of high versus low functioning, simply because very often, the word high functioning is used as a way of saying that people who, for instance, can talk or have less noticeable impairments don't need support, whereas the word low functioning is used as an excuse to segregate or not provide opportunities to people who can't talk or who have more obvious impairments. I think we generally view it better to describe people by virtue of their objective characteristics.
So talking versus not talking, is that what you mean?
Well, I think that's one definite attribute, but there's a lot of variety on the autism spectrum. Some of it relates to whether or not somebody talks. Other aspects of it relate to the different sensory hyper or hyposensitivities a person has, how somebody perceives the social world. The autism spectrum is somewhat unique among disabilities in that it really isn't simply across one dimension, but the attributes of autism are multidimensional and thus somewhat complex to explain in simplistic terms.
If I could ask you a question, picking up on something you just said, Ari, you said how you perceive the social world. How do you feel you experience the world differently from other people, Ari?
Well, I've never been other people, so I think that's a
take a guess.
Difficult question. It's interesting because I think a lot of people ask me that and ask other autistic people that, and I think the first point I would explain here is, well, we're born the way we are, so the primary thing that we experience, causes us to notice that we are different is how others treat us and how we interact with the world around us. So one of the things that certainly has always been very noticeable to me is that there is a whole host of social assumptions that many of us on the spectrum either don't pick up on or have difficulty communicating with. And, if you're a person with a physical disability, there's a certain degree of knowledge as to how to accommodate your needs. If you see a building with a staircase, then there's a recognition that, there's a need for a ramp. But what we're trying to explain and what the neurodiversity movement aims to explain is that there are also barriers of social architecture as well as physical architecture. And that very often that can also be a big part of excluding us from the broader world, be it a school or a workplace or a place of public accommodation or otherwise.
Can you explain, just give us an example, Ari? You said social assumptions you don't pick up on. What's a concrete example of that?
Well, a whole host of things that people communicate around and talk about are implied rather than explicit. They may relate to a tone of voice, or they may relate to some type of other unspoken assumption that people are making. This sort of host of things that people assume that because the people around me are like me, I can assume that they know these things. And because our brains work differently, very often we don't pick up on those things. We perhaps don't know what a particular phrase means. We don't know what's considered the most socially appropriate thing to do in a particular situation. And as a result of that, very often we run into challenges. So, among the things that ASAN is trying to do is ensure that just as there's a recognition that sometimes accommodations are needed in the context of architectural barriers and other things, that when we talk about policies and practices, there's also a need for accommodations on a social level as well.
And ASAN is the group that you have founded, Autism Self-Advocacy Network, right, Ari?
The Autistic Self-Advocacy Network,
right.
Yes. People can find out more about us at our website at www.autisticadvocacy.org.
In the series that Sharwich Kern did, Ari, she asked you, if there were a pill that you could take to wipe out all your autistic symptoms, would you take it? And you said no.
Yes, that's correct.
How come?
Well, to be frank, I think it's something of a silly question. You know, like I said, I was born this way. Autistic people are born autistic. You can't necessarily just, carve out a section of our brain and say, well, this is the autistic part and the rest is the non-autistic part. Autism is pervasive. It characterizes how we experience the world, how we perceive things, how we communicate things. There isn't a non-autistic Ari hiding underneath some autistic shell. And I think that's part of what we want to get across, that namely the objective of autism advocacy and research and education and service provision shouldn't be to make non-autistic people. It should be to make happy, contributing autistic people who can enjoy equal rights and equal opportunity in our society.
Well, Ari, it's really nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
That's Ari Ne'eman, founder of the Autism Self-Advocacy Network and a member of the National Council on Disability. Join us with your questions and comments now at 1-800-892-6477. Your personal experiences with this issue, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Kristen Murphy, I'd like to go to you before we go to the phones. Again, director of the New Hampshire Council on Autism Spectrum Disorders, with a 16-year-old son who has autism. I'm thinking that a lot of what Ari said rings very familiar for you, Kristen.
Oh, absolutely. I similarly would never want, and I have two sons affected by this type of disorder. I would never want them to change. I love the talents that they have. The things that have caused them acute pain and anxiety growing up, I would want to take those things away, but I certainly don't want them to be different people. They're immensely talented. My older son, who I haven't mentioned yet, has a diagnosis of Asperger's. He's a very talented budding filmmaker, and he does stumble a lot socially, and I want to protect him and help him with that, but I don't want him to be a different person at all.
Cheryl, did you want to jump in there? You touched on this in the beginning.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting when Ari said, you know, we don't like to use terms like high and low functioning to describe autism. And one thing I was also hearing from educators was do not presume competence. In other words, if there is a child who's not speaking that well, we don't know what they really understand and do not understand, and we don't really know how far they could go. And that was interesting to me. That was kind of an eye opener. And sometimes people, for various reasons, have trouble talking, whether it's a neurological disorder, it could be a stroke or whatever. But that doesn't mean that there's not a lot inside there of knowledge and expression. They just don't know how to get it out.
Our phone number again is 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, let's go to the phones now. Ruby's up from Londonderry. Hi, Ruby, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I'm actually the mother of two children, one who is definitely on the spectrum and the other one who's showing some signs, the speech delay. He seems emotionally capable compared to his peers, so we're watching it. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the increased awareness and the increased diagnosis of it. My mom had an interesting point. In the past, people who tended to have these traits tended to be the engineers, the intellectuals who were in a workplace. Their only exposure to mates tended to be the more socially capable people, like the secretaries. But then women who had some of these traits, who would have normally been homemakers, entered the workforce in the 70s and such. So you had people with these abilities and traits and talents and maybe social awkwardness meeting each other and finding their soulmates and having children with some of these issues. My husband and I realized in watching our daughter that we have some of these same behaviors and that we exhibited some of the same issues early on. We're both capable interfacing people with our societies, but we have some of the unreasonableness, the expectations, the rigidness, the disdain for certain constructs the society expects that other people on the spectrum have. And our daughter has them, too.
Well, Ruby, hold on, because we talked for just a minute with Ellen Cavanaugh. Again, she's a nurse practitioner who works on this issue about the causes, the genetics, and so forth. A real interesting call from Ruby there, Ellen.
Right. That is interesting, Ruby. We find in our practice also there are families who come up, and once you do a good developmental history, you'll find either one or both of the parents or some people in the family who've had these characteristics who in hindsight might have been diagnosed on the spectrum. And I think that gives – I think your mother-in-law had a good insight about it. It gives people hope that, you know, you can be different, just like Ari says. Just you're experiencing life differently, and there's a place for everyone. And thank goodness we're in this decade where there's more awareness, there's more technology, there's more research money going into understanding it. And we're not really trying to change somebody's genetic profile, but really trying to enhance them so they flourish, like Ari says. They flourish and bloom with their own animation, with their own perspective, and that we are able to ensure that these little children are going to grow up happy.
Although when you say there's a place for everyone, and I don't want to be a downer here, but, you know, if you're trying to manage a classroom of 25 children and two of them are exhibiting autistic behaviors, it can make it very difficult, Cheryl, for a public school teacher to handle that classroom. So this gets into the whole inclusion thing, and we could do 17 hours of programming on this. But Cheryl, this is an issue. Yes, you want to, you know, make room for everyone, as Ellen says, and yet it's challenging when you have 25 kids in front of you and two of them seem to be acting out.
Well, I remember what a couple of special educators said to me is, yes, if a child is acting out, we will remove that child from the classroom. But that could happen with any child. It isn't necessarily a child who has autism. So, yes, if there's some sort of disruption happening, that child will be removed. But also, you know, sometimes there are kids with autistic behaviors that may do things like rocking or hand flapping, and that's just they're calming themselves down. And the other kids in the classroom have gotten used to that. So they're not reacting, and they're becoming more accepting. So there's a balance there.
Interesting. All right, let's take another call. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Up next from Hancock is Robert. Hi, Robert, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have kind of a unique perspective where I have a son who has Asperger's syndrome, but I'm also on the local school board. So I look at this from two different perspectives. One, of making sure that my son is getting all of the things that he needs to be a happy, productive member of society, and also looking at it from the school board's aspect of people looking at children with IEPs somehow feel that a lot of times by the child getting an IEP or them getting something special, that it's diminishing from what they would term neurotypical children in their educational experience. So there's a lot of backlash sometimes in that, and I don't blame the parents for that. I have, you know, I understand that. But you do tend to see it that, you know, people say, well, you know, that these kids are getting everything they need because they, you know, they have autism, and my child doesn't get it because, you know, that the autistic child may act up in class and my child doesn't get the education that he needs. So there's sometimes a disconnect between the parents, and like I said, being on the school board, I can certainly understand both sides. And I guess the other thing that you and your guests have talked about is the whole thought process of curing, quote-unquote, autism. I wouldn't change my son for anything. My son, John, he'll be 8 actually tomorrow. He is the sweetest, most loving child in the world who happens to have Asperger's syndrome. And the only thing that I wish for him is to be a happy, functioning member of society when he grows up. And anything else, I would not, if I changed anything about him or took anything away from him, he wouldn't be John. And I would miss that tremendously. So,
well, Robert, let me ask you about what you brought up initially, because it's interesting. When people say to you at school board meetings, gee, how come your kid gets all the services and mine doesn't, and so forth, how do you try to bridge that divide there?
Personally, when I came onto the school board, which was just a little over 7 months ago, I made it plain that I was not coming on as an advocate for special needs children, even though my son was one. I was coming on as an advocate for all children. and that I understand that there is a tightrope that we walk as school board members and as educators and everything else that's involved with our children. And so I try to make people understand that just because my son or somebody else's son or daughter is getting this, that I look out for all of the children that are involved in this and trying to make sure that the education that's brought to them is the highest that we can possibly afford.
Well, Robert, it's good to hear from you. Kristen Murphy, what do you think about Robert's call?
Oh, it's a very interesting point, and I think that we are seeing perhaps more backlash as school budgets are so tight right now. And I fear that. I'm sorry about that. I wish that, weren't happening, because really, I think you have to take a bigger picture look. Public schools are public institutions, and the overall goal is to make sure that we have a functioning workforce of adults moving up and paying taxes and working in the jobs that make our society a good place to live. And sure, there may be impacts this year or that year on any given school budget, but what we want is to meet the individualized needs of kids so we have tomorrow's workforce assured.
Well, Robert, thanks a lot for that call. And a question for you, Ellen Cavanaugh. We've talked about treatment, but we haven't really, and the importance of it, we haven't really talked about what that means. When we talk about treatment, are we talking about drugs? Are we talking about behavior therapy? Are we talking about parenting techniques? What are we talking about here?
Well, the major treatment is to treat the disorder that's interrupting the child's development, and that's the primary social interactive. If they don't have language, the treatment is speech and language therapy. If children do have language, sometimes they don't understand language, and they're using it in black and white. They still need speech and language therapy. So speech and language therapists are pivotal in the therapy, beginning at a very early age when parents first identify at around 18 months that the child's not gaining language as naturally as they should be. So that's the very first therapy, is speech and language. Early intervention is critical. We have early intervention throughout the whole state of New Hampshire and Vermont. These folks who are out there, they're providing, frontline treatment for babies, because you can't take babies into school and provide hours and hours of therapy. So they're teaching parents. So parents are important. And then in the educational system. And then you're transitioning that child over into public or private school.
Well, and in your series show, you talked about adults now coming into the workforce. We'll talk about that after a break and take more of your calls. So keep it right here.
I'm Betsy Gardella, president of New Hampshire Public Radio. Throughout the year, you turn to NHPR for comprehensive coverage of news like the recent midterm elections, for engaging conversations like the Socrates Exchange, and for in-depth reporting like our special series, Challenges of Autism, airing this week. These and all of the projects we undertake at NHPR are made possible because of your support. Thank you.
This is NHPR, where support comes from you, our members, and from the New Hampshire Community Loan Fund, where loans and education help borrowers create opportunity and transform lives. Information at communityloanfund.org. And from Ansel and Anderson, trust and estate attorneys helping families create thoughtful estate plans designed to minimize family conflict. On the web at anselpa.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, a panel of New Hampshire Republicans joins us on their agenda for the coming legislative year. Email us your questions at exchange@nhpr.org and join us Monday morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, rising autism in the Granite State and the 300% increase in diagnosis just over the past decade. We're looking at the challenges of autism through a series done by NHPR correspondent Sherwich Kern today. It looks at the impact of autism on families, schools, communities, health providers. Let's hear from you. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. And for more now on the school piece, we go to Santina Thibodeau. She's director of the Bureau for Special Education at the New Hampshire Department of Education. And Santina Thibodeau, nice to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, we keep going back to this 300% increase number, Santina. How has that affected New Hampshire's public schools?
Mm-hmm. Well, with the 300% increase, just to give you a little background, from a school perspective, back in 2000, we had about 400 students with autism. Now we're up to about 1,600.
Wow. So from 2000, you had 400, and now it's 1,600. Big increase.
Yes. Although for that same time period, our total number of students with IEPs, or students needing special ed services, only increased about 100 students.
You know, we talk about the issue of inclusion, and I wonder, Santina, how common is it for children with autism to be included in the regular classroom with other kids?
Well, our state has had a long history of having students with IEPs, or including students with autism, being educated in our public schools.
Is that standard across the board, or is it different from district to district, Santina?
I think it actually would depend on the particular student, and it's really based on the student's needs and the IEP process, if they're going to be educated within a public school or if they're going to be educated in what we would call an out-of-district placement.
So we don't. It's different with every school and every child, it sounds like.
It is, and it's actually through our special ed process called an IEP.
Mm-hmm. Individual Education Plan.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So how do you, Santina, see the public schools balancing the needs of autistic children with the needs of everyone else? I mean, we've talked about this a little bit, making sure that, quote-unquote, normal children get the attention they need, mm-hmm. as well as the autistic child.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's really through that individual education program, but as we heard earlier on the earlier speaker was talking about speech and language, or speech and language pathologists. And the struggle that schools are having is that students with autism often require a more direct instruction or more one-on-one, and it's really finding those service providers, such as people who can do our occupational therapy, our physical therapy, our speech and language pathologists, as well as our certified educators and paraprofessionals.
So do they have the resources to do this?
At this point, we have a critical shortage in the areas I just mentioned. So school districts are really trying to be creative to have those needs filled.
So is it a question of money, or just that there aren't talented folks out there to do this, that trained folks to do this?
Right, and I think that you just hit on the key point, is having the people who are appropriately trained who can then provide the services. So, for example, right now we have a lack of licensed or appropriate speech and language pathologists. So what's happening in many schools is that individual may have to drive from one school in the morning, see a few students, get in their car, drive to the next school, see a few students, which really puts a burden not only on that provider, but actually just getting through the day and being able to see enough students.
Well, one last question for you, Santina, please. Given the huge rise that you just told us about, what do you think is going to happen? I mean, is the state going to be able to deal with this or not?
Mm-hmm. Well, what a lot of our school districts are doing right now is that they're looking for individuals, maybe a paraprofessional, and working with that paraprofessional to support them, that they can then become a certified teacher. That will, again, help with the shortage piece. They're doing lots of advertising. Come work in New Hampshire. We're the best state. Actually, our New Hampshire Technical Institute has just created a new program, and it's Autism Early Intervention Specialist. So by creating that program, it's another resource. We can grow our own here in our state, and this would be a certification or a certificate program that would allow these individuals to work with the early intervention that we had heard earlier.
Well, Santina, thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Santina Thibodeau, Director of the Bureau of Special Education at the New Hampshire Department of Education. Our number is 1-800-892-6477. The email exchange at nhpr.org. And here's an email that I'd like to share with you all. This person didn't given name. They say, thank you, by the way, Cheryl, for doing this series. This person says, referring to benefits to New Hampshire taxpayers, one of the interviewees said, because in many cases schools are paying for the therapy, I hope your listeners understand that the benefit to school and taxpayers of appropriate early intervention go far beyond the cost of the therapy itself. The huge benefit is that kids who get appropriate early intervention will be far more able to learn without extra supports, greatly reducing special education costs that will otherwise mushroom if the kids don't get early interventions they need. This person concludes by saying early intervention may seem expensive, but it will be far more expensive not to provide what the kids need. Sherwich Kern, is this a theme that kept coming up in your series?
Definitely, it was a theme. I mean, I remember Kirsten Murphy commenting on that too, because the cost to society for adults who haven't received services, I'm not exactly sure what the figure was, I think an average of $60,000 a year, and Kirsten can correct me on that. But that is a major point, and I believe I touched upon that in the series, that early intervention works, and it's effective, and it does, in the long run, save money.
Because, as you pointed out in the series, we focus so much on children, but some of these quote-unquote children are, you know, almost adults ready to go to college or into the workforce.
Correct.
Did you want to jump in there,
yes,
too,
Ellen? I'd also like to say that there's a secondary effect also that we need to consider, and that's what it does to the family, the stress on the family. Because if that child is not gainfully employed or educated, it creates an incredible pressure on the mother, usually. But fathers are taking more and more responsibility. It's a shared family burden if that child does not get educated and get the appropriate therapy. So that's especially in New Hampshire, where we have the huge northern rural population that can be relatively isolated. And I just wanted to add, I had one family where they lived in a very small rural community. There was only the child was autistic, and there were no services. The mother learned ABA, and thanks to a very...
ABA is what, Ellen?
Applied behavioral analysis.
Okay.
She learned how to facilitate behavior for her child. She got certified thanks to a very open school board who invited her in, who paid for her to be certified. That mother went on and germinated another mother, and now they've doubled their ABA therapists in that school.
I can hear Kirsten wanting to jump in. Go ahead, Kirsten.
That's a great story. You know, the figure that gets cited a lot in terms of long-term cost is a fairly conservatively constructed study that was done at the Harvard School of Public Health. And the finding was that for someone with full-blown autism who does not receive treatment, the average lifetime impact on society, the cost to society, is $3.2 million. And 90% of that cost is in adult services. So it's a very, very... high expensive condition, if you will, high cost condition. But with early intervention, we know 47% of kids will do so well that their functional level is indistinguishable from their peers in kindergarten. Another 40% will make significant gains. So with those kind of outcomes, you know, we need to think about some of this intensive behavior-based, developmentally sequenced therapy as medical intervention and medically necessary treatment. And I know that's why I've worked hard to try to have some insurance coverage for some of those therapies as well, rather than just looking to the schools as the sole provider of services after the age of three.
Let's take another call. This is Lewis in Rumney. Hi, Lewis, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, good morning, Laura. I worked as a teacher in Florida and up here in New Hampshire. In Florida, I had an autistic student in the class, and problem wasn't with the student. The problem was with another student who needed to try to show herself better. I had to work through her. I you know, she would try to distract the autistic student and was successful and impressed the other students by doing so. I had to work with her and, frankly, get her out of the class so that the autistic student could go back to learning. She was a very specific linear learning student, and she had received a lot of help and was doing quite well. Up here in New Hampshire, I saw something very, very interesting at a private school I taught at. There was an older fellow, an older gentleman, had been associated with the school for a long, long time. And if I had to move someone out of the classroom that was being distractive, this older fellow took that young man in and was really able to help him. I don't know where we are. I realize there's budgets and expenses and costs, but one of the things that I really think school systems need to do is to try to integrate some of the retired folks into this, some of whom may really have some good skills in this area. And the hallway is darn quiet. And if there's a way that we can get those kids right in with somebody that's like this, we may be able to help.
Very interesting, Lewis. What do you think, Ellen Cavanaugh?
I think that's a great idea, and I think it's been used in some of the New Hampshire school systems. I know some of my students have paraeducators who are retired teachers, and they're very successful in developing a good relationship with the student and facilitating the education just a little bit faster. There are other people who are in the paraeducator positions who aren't educated, because it's a relatively low-paying position, and the student doesn't make quite as much progress. So it would be a good study to look at the difference, you know, long-term, getting a retired teacher in versus an unskilled parent or educator.
I want to share an email with all of you. Thanks, Lewis, for that call. Just part of what this person says. This is Joan. She says she's a speech-language pathologist who's worked for more than 20 years in public schools in Vermont, seen many students with autism go through their school years with relative success. Joan says her biggest concern is post-graduation. The opportunity for safe and supported social interaction dwindles after school, and often many young adults rely only on their families for social support. Social interaction, Joan says, for many of these people means being with people and having an activity to do. Not just hanging out, she says, but having an activity. What do you think, Cheryl? Did you hear this from other young adults that you talked to?
Yes, I did, and it certainly was a concern, because it's as if in the school system, and you know, in New Hampshire, or I think nationally, you can have a free and appropriate education up till the age of 21. So some of these kids stay in the school system. They do get a lot of supports, and then there is a very big distinction to what happens afterwards. Well, I talked to one parent who was looking at the community college, and the community college was offering some of their psychology major students to become mentors to this person. So there are some creative ways they can get supports. They may not be as structured as they are in the school system. But it certainly is a challenge. And I found parents who worked hard to get their kids involved in things that they were interested in, like karate, art, photography. And that provided a means for them to become socially active.
And let's take another call. This is Gretchen in Manchester. Hi, Gretchen, you're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a son who, he's 15 now, and we've been in several schools. He's actually been, you know, thrown out of a couple of schools because of behavior issues. And I'm thinking that he's got an autism spectrum disorder, and I'm trying to figure out how I pursue that diagnosis.
Wow. Okay. That's tough, Gretchen. I'm sorry to hear that. Kirsten Murphy, what do you think?
I think you should talk with your primary care provider and see if you can't get a referral to a psychologist, psychiatrist, or a developmental specialist. We have plenty of good instruments that allow us to figure that out, even with, you know, someone who's 15. Not everyone is diagnosed at the age of 2.5.
Well, and it's interesting, Ellen, because we've heard about a lot of people first being diagnosed when they're 2 or 5 or 9, but here's our caller, 15, and she's not sure.
Yes, and she can go to, you know, get the referral, as Kristen said, go to a child development center. There are several in the state. There's the big one in the Seacoast. Manchester area has one. We have one in Lebanon. And your son can be seen. It takes a little bit more work going through the developmental history because there's more history to go through, but it certainly can be pinpointed, and he may get a diagnosis even at this age.
Okay. So. Well, Gretchen, good luck to you, and thanks for calling in. And all of you, just to finish up, and Ellen, I want to turn to you again. How much do you expect these autism numbers to keep rising? Or is there a point where we can reasonably expect a plateau?
I think that with better identification and the earlier identification, we might see a little bit more of an increase, because pediatricians, family practitioners, nurse practitioners, those that are out in the field from birth through 18 months are screening children now. And there are a couple of very good screening instruments, and if the child fails a screening instrument twice, they're referred on. So we should see more referrals. And with the increase in that, you know, looking we're now looking for children who are on that spectrum, because we know if we can identify them early and give them the services, we will prevent. So even if we overdiagnose as young babies, if they would get the services so that by kindergarten they look, they can learn along with their peers. So we've created a healthier population.
All right. So again, looking at the rise not only as a terrible thing, but a chance to do something early so that it doesn't create more problems later on.
Because these screening instruments actually do may overdiagnose.
And Kirsten, to you, what's the final message or thought that you want to leave people with about this? Again, you have two sons who have autism.
I guess my final message would be simply that we've got still a lot of work to do on a number of fronts, developing and shifting our infrastructure in the state so we can support kids that are getting diagnosed. And also we have a lot of work to do in terms of opening our minds and just learning to live alongside and interact with folks on the spectrum.
Okay. Final thoughts from you, Cheryl?
Yeah, along the lines of what happens with young adults after they enter the workforce, I think, you know, we need more training for some of these students or graduates to get into the workforce. And I know that there are social services out there, and I just think the state health and education departments need to work together to make that happen more.
All right. And Cheryl, again, congratulations and thanks for being with
us
today. And also Ellen Kavanaugh, thank you for being here.
Thank you very much.
And Kirsten Murphy, thank you for your time.
Thanks very much. Bye-bye.
The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The producer is Will Roselip. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
Views expressed on this program were those of the individuals and not necessarily those of New Hampshire Public Radio or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange tonight at 8 p.m. after Fresh Air or anytime at nhpr.org. CD copies of The Exchange are available by calling 603-228-8910 or by visiting nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we begin with a panel of Granite State Republicans on what they hope to accomplish after their near sweep of New Hampshire's midterm elections. Then a national transportation analyst comes to the Granite State with his take on the true costs of getting from here to there. And the Socrates Exchange explores the question, what is gratitude? Email us at nhpr.org and join us all next week for The Exchange, live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.